This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at what the Supreme Court is up to as they begin their new term today.
First, we continue our discussion with David Lewis on the science of impulse. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Can you not resist the impulse to buy that candy bar, eat that treat? Do you judge people on impulse, love at first sight, or you don't believe in it? 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org. David, we interrupted you mid-story about Charles Darwin acting on impulse. The story so far, he had deciding if he's going to get married or not, made the pros and cons list. Pick it up from there.
Yes, he did. That's 1836. He's just come back off the Beagle. He decides he ought to get married, but he's not sure, so he makes this list. On one side of the paper, he writes reasons for marrying. On the other side, he writes reasons for not marrying. He sort of puts down all the pluses and all the, as he sees it, all the minuses. He adds them all up, and he decides he should get married. And in fact, at the bottom of the list, he wrote QED, marry, marry, marry. And he got married, and he remained married for the rest of his life, for over 30 years. It was a very happy marriage, very fruitful marriage. Lots of children. And so here he clearly used what we called before System R, this reasoned, rational, scientific approach, which many people, I think, would think was pretty unromantic. But let's look at another famous person, Bertrand Russell. Now, Bertrand Russell fell in love when he was 17. He fell in love with a 23-year-old. He waited until he was of age, which in those days would have been 21. He then proposed to her, and they got married. But they didn't stay married. In fact, Russell, in the course of his life, I went through, had four wives. I knew Russell. I used to stay sometimes at his house in Wales, which was a very interesting experience. And his last wife, absolutely lovely lady, called Edith. They were a very loving couple. But nonetheless, he was very much more of a system I kind of guy. He fell in love at first sight, and unfortunately, he fell out of love just as easily.
Yeah, but when Charles Darwin or anyone sits down and makes their lists and does their research, aren't we often just confirming our gut feeling in the first place?
Well, you know, I think that's a very interesting supposition, because I think it's often true. Somebody said to me, if you want to know how to make a decision, toss a coin. Not that you should actually rely on how the coin falls, but as the coin is sort of turning in space, you'll know which way you want it to land, because that's actually kind of your gut feeling is, well, I want to do this or I don't want to do this. So as the coin is spinning, you think, well, I hope it lands heads, because if it lands heads, I'm going to do it or I'm not going to do it. So I think you're right. Very often we kind of intellectualize. We say, wow, that's the reason I did it. But there seems to be a part of the brain called the frontal cortex, the part of the brain at the front or the front of the head, just above the eyes, which acts as a kind of a monitor, which imposes self-control. It kind of stops us doing our impulse. It sort of says, well, hang on a second there. Just think about it before you act. And in children, this is one of the last parts of the brain to develop, which is why young people, teenagers especially, are very prone to risk-taking. They're very impulsive. They don't really think through their actions. It's simply because their brains are still developing, and they continue to develop up to about the age of early 20s in some cases. But if you suffer any damage to that part of the brain, the frontal cortex, it can make you very much more impulsive, very much less sort of responsible. There's a famous case in America. It goes back to the 19th century. Any of your listeners who sort of done psychology will have certainly have come across his case, because it's curious, because this man was a 19th century railroad worker, a man called Phineas Gage, and his job was to blow up rocks. And the way they did this was to drill a hole in the rock. They then filled it with explosive. He then used a long steel pole, a tamping rod, to stamp the explosive down, having put sand on the explosive first. And then they would light the fuse and stand back, and the rock would blow up, and they could proceed with the railway. He was building railways. Now, on one occasion, he got careless, and he actually pushed the rod into the hole on top of the explosives before they put any sand there. And there was an explosion, and this rod then traveled up through his head. It went in under his left eye and came out of the top of his head and landed many yards away, and it destroyed most of the front parts of his brain. But amazingly, in those days, because they had no anesthetic, they had no anesthesia, they had no painkillers, no analgesia, he survived. But everybody said that the Gage who survived with part of his brain missing was not the Gage they'd known. And from being a very responsible, hardworking, diligent sort of guy, he'd become much more impulsive, much less responsible. He changed jobs frequently. And in fact, after his death, his skull was dug up and is actually, I think, in the Yale Museum, and you can see it alongside this tamping rod. But it's a very, very famous case in neuroscience because it demonstrated for the first time that certain parts of the brain seem to have a specific function, a localization of function within the brain.
Well, it sounds like even as you talked about Charles Darwin's very rational approach to deciding whether to get married, that even at the basis of this, there's a natural propensity to be impulsive. Is this something that can be changed, or is it just something that is natural to us?
I think there's probably a genetic component. I think some people are much more sort of prone to impulsivity. Actually, any of your male listeners might want to try this. It's a test which is actually quite accurate. If you measure your second digit and your fourth digit, so it's called the 2D, 4D test. If you take the ratio of the length of your second digit of your dominant hand, so if you're right-handed, that would be your right hand, and so the second digit is the one next to the thumb, and the fourth digit is for the fourth digit, and you compare the ratio. If it's less than one, it's likely that you're more of a risk taker. You're more likely to be a risk taker, more likely to act impulsively. And this is because it means that when you were in the womb, you received more testosterone. And this is a measure. It affects both the way your brain works, but it also affects, rather strangely, the length of your digits. But it only works with men.
Interesting.
Why only men?
It's the testosterone thing?
It doesn't work with women. It has no effect on women. But this 2D 4D ratio less than one is one of the indications that people are likely to be risk takers, and also levels of testosterone have an enormous impact on how impulsive people are. A study carried out by two researchers at Cambridge University looked at the amount of testosterone in the bloodstream of high risk, high frequency traders. In London, and they found that on the days when they were taking very big risks, you know, sort of gambling millions of dollars or millions of pounds, their levels of testosterone were much higher. So again, there does seem to be a hormonal factor in how risk-taking people are, in a sense how impulsive they are.
Well, let's get a call from a possibly impulsive listener. We've got Dana on the line in Montello. Dana, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have an impulsive thing, I guess. Back in 98, I went backpacking around Europe alone. And
okay.
About 6 months before I left for my trip, I met this gentleman in a bar who told me he liked my girlfriend. And it just happened to be anybody that liked her never liked me and vice versa. So I really believed he liked her. Well, apparently it was all a ploy. He really just wanted to talk to me.
Uh-huh.
Well, before I left for Europe, I told him, hey, I'm leaving for Europe in, you know, a couple weeks here. And knowing he had been stationed in Europe, you know, I thought he'd be interested to talk to me about it, places where to go, and et cetera. And he said, oh, you know, that's too bad that you're leaving because I always wanted to ask you out. And I was, like, just thrown back. And we went out for about 2 weeks, and it was this real hard decision to actually go and stay together and not go to Europe and or get on the plane and go. And he said, you'd present me if I made you stay. So, well, the two-week relationship ended. And it's not my way of, you know, getting, you know, falling in love and, you know, fantasizing that every man I ever met I'm going to marry. So it wasn't that big of a deal, you know, to date to date. Well, I get to Europe, I travel around for about 6 months, and everything I would write in my little journal. And I'd start in my journal, you know, I miss my mom, I miss my dad, I miss, you know, McDonald's hamburgers, I miss, you know, something about America. And just by impulse or whatever, I wrote, I miss Leonard, my now husband. And it threw me. I'm like, Leonard, really? I mean, out of all the men I dated, he was a very short person, you know, very short period
Dana,
of time.
Dana, we do have to wrap this up real quick. Can you tell us what happened?
And so I came back from Europe, and just by impulse, I looked him up, and 3 months later, we got married.
And you're still married?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I'm going to be married 6 years this January.
Well, congratulations, Dana. So a happy ending, excuse me, to an impulse story there.
Indeed, absolutely.
Well, David, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about what's behind our impulses.
My pleasure. Always a delight.
David Lewis is the founder and director at MindLab International at the Sussex Innovation Center and author of Impulse, Why We Do What We Do Without Knowing Why We Do It.
Coming up next, it's day one of the Supreme Court's new term. We'll take a look at what awaits them.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll look at the top cases before the Supreme Court as it kicks off a new session.
First, a look at frac sand mining in Wisconsin. There are now about 100 sand mine facilities in Wisconsin. They bring jobs and money into small communities. But as the number of frac sand mines grows in the state, so do questions about its effects on public health. In part one of a two-part series, Tegan Wendland with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looks at a byproduct of the process, dust.
Frances Sales lives in New Auburn, which has 5 sand mine facilities within a 4-mile radius. She says the community has changed since the sand companies moved in, and so has her life.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm good. This is your place, huh?
Yes, it is.
And it looks like you swept it today.
Yes, I did.
But what does it usually look like in here?
Sand. Sand. Lots of sand.
Sales, a retired nursing assistant who has lived in New Auburn for 25 years, says she's worried about how the dust could be affecting her health. Her asthma has gotten worse, and though she's considered moving, her family can't afford to. UW-Eau Claire professor Crispin Pierce says there is some cause for concern. Long-term exposure may pose a risk, and the most dangerous dust is invisible.
We know that the small particles that are generated from sand mining and operating things like sandblasting are really quite toxic. They cause silicosis, they cause lung cancer, they cause cardiovascular disease. Now with the proliferation of mines, we don't have a lot of good information about people living or working or traveling near sand mines.
Pierce is trying to fill holes in the research himself, but his methods are controversial. He uses small, low-cost monitors instead of industrial ones and sets them up wherever landowners let him. He says that while the DNR is monitoring some of the frac sand sites, it's not enough. There are only 13 monitors for about 100 mines and processing plants. Some activists say the industry has grown so fast, the government hasn't been able to keep up in protecting people from its potential impacts. But DNR Air Official Jeff Johnson says that while his agency has added a few new frac sand positions, it still doesn't have the money to research health impacts.
We mainly focus on inspections at major sources of air pollution, so foundries, your power plants, things of that nature. A lot of the industrial sand mines are what we would term minor sources, and unfortunately we didn't have a whole lot of funding in that part of the program.
Dwayne Wilkie is Environmental Health and Safety Manager at Superior Silica in New Auburn. As he walks through the plant, he says his facility is doing enough to keep dust down. Workers change the plant air filters, and they keep piles of sand wet so it doesn't blow away.
My daughter is 15. She goes to school in New Auburn. I would never do anything to harm the air quality, to harm my own daughter in the school.
State Senator Kathleen Vinehout says Superior Silica might be doing a good job reducing the chances of blowing sand, but the problem is that the DNR doesn't enforce standards like this for the industry as a whole, which is why she's proposing legislation to fund more DNR inspectors.
What we need is monitoring at the edges of the mines and a continuous monitoring, so it's not just one time, but there's continuous information that we're receiving on what the problems are on a particular site.
In the meantime, Vinehout says Wisconsin should look to neighboring states for guidance. The Minnesota Department of Health has set up a guideline to protect people from the dust, and the University of Iowa plans to study the potential health risk for communities near the mines. In Wisconsin, EOG Resources, a private company, is studying air quality at 4 of its facilities. The company declined to comment on the study. Preliminary results, though, show low concentrations of the dust. Vinehout and State Representative Chris Dano are working on legislation this session to increase funding and staffing for the DNR. Tegan Wendland, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Tegan for that report. Coming up tomorrow, part two in our WPR News series on frac sand mining with a look at water quality near the mines. This is Central Time. The nine Supreme Court justices are settling in for another term of consequential cases today in Washington.
The last two terms saw highly anticipated rulings. They upheld the Affordable Care Act in 2012 and struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act and Defense of Marriage Act this past June.
Here with us to discuss what's on the table this coming term is New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So as we said, the past two terms saw some historic decisions passed down. Do we have any high voltage things going on this time?
This term has maybe half a dozen cases that in the ordinary term would seem really important, and only by contrast to the blockbusters of the last couple terms do they seem a little bit in the shadows. But the court is going to rule on campaign finance, on public prayer, on aspects of abortion, on affirmative action. That's a pretty good term.
Right up front is the campaign finance, as I understand it. What's the case and what's at stake there?
So you can think of it as a sequel to the very controversial 2010 Citizens United case. Citizens United basically deregulated half of the campaign finance system. You can think of campaign finance regulation as two basic ideas. One of them, which was the part in Citizens United, was about independent spending. And it allowed corporations and unions to say what they like about political candidates so long as it was independent of the candidates, uncoordinated with the candidates. This new case called McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, to be argued tomorrow, looks at the other half of the equation, not independent spending, but direct contributions to candidates. And it asks the question of whether some limits on contributions are unconstitutional, whether they violate the First Amendment.
So this is a limit. Rob Ferret can only donate $500 in this particular race to this particular candidate?
Yes, yeah, so that's the basic idea. It gets a little more complicated. In federal elections, there's a limit of $2,600 per election from individuals. Corporations and unions, before and after Citizens United, aren't allowed to give directly to candidates, but individual people are. But they're subject to that $2,600 limit. That limit is not challenged in this case. What's challenged instead is an overall limit of roughly $48,000. So I can give to the first candidate, the second candidate, the third candidate, but at some point I run out of money in that overall limit, so-called aggregate limit. And the question in the case is, does that make any sense? Am I going to corrupt the system somehow by giving to 18 candidates rather than 17?
And this affects only federal races, or would this be a donation, a race, say, for governor of Wisconsin?
The case directly affects only federal races, and there are states with and without contribution limits, so it wouldn't directly affect state races.
So I know arguments haven't started yet, but what are the arguments of the people opposed to this change?
So the people defending the current system say that it's very easy to circumvent these limits. And basically, if you give it to enough candidates and parties, the money is fungible and it will find its way to the people you want to have influence with. And that if there are large enough sums of money involved, that will lead to corruption.
Money will find a way, though, people would say, if they're going to change it, why not have more direct donations from individuals to the candidates out in the open?
Yeah, so that's a counterargument that after Citizens United, the untold sums of money are being spent about candidates, but not controlled by the candidates and often not subject to disclosure. So you have some people saying we'd be better off to have the people accountable for the message, the candidates themselves, who are required to disclose their contributors getting the money rather than shadowy groups running around putting up ads for and against given candidates.
And in handicapping what the justices might do, are people expecting a repeat of the division that we saw in the Citizens United case?
Well, what we know about the court led by John Roberts is it has this the seventh campaign finance case it's going to hear. In the first six, it voted against campaign finance regulations. Now, almost all of those were in the independent expenditure side. But nonetheless, this is a court that's skeptical of campaign finance regulation and thinks that at least much of it violates the First Amendment.
We're talking to New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak about the new session of the Supreme Court. We'll get into some of the other issues he mentioned, things like abortion rights, public prayer, presidential power, and more coming up. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Your thoughts on something they're considering, your thoughts on whether the court has become too politicized or not politicized enough. 800-642-1234.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up, are we entering a post-antibiotic era? The CDC says we may be. We'll find out why and what that means.
Now we continue our conversation about the Supreme Court's new term. Adam Liptak is with us. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. You can join in with your questions about this term of the Supreme Court and the big issues there at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Adam, we touched on the campaign finance case before the Supreme Court. We'll get into some of the other issues you mentioned. But first, you recently wrote a piece about Justice Ginsburg, pressure from some Democrats for her to step down, to retire now while there's still a Democrat in the White House. How has she responded to those calls?
She's given lots of interviews suggesting that she's not going anywhere, that she loves the job, that she's good at it. She enjoys being the senior member of the court's liberal wing. And I take her at her word. She's 80 years old, but she's energetic and whip smart, in full command of the arguments and materials. And she told the Washington Post over the weekend that she expects a Democrat to be elected in 2016, suggesting that she's got no strategic reason to step down, although I don't know how good her crystal ball is.
It's amazing how there are these nine jobs. They've been such a big issue for presidential politics. Who's going to be right there to appoint the next justice, and when are they going to decide they can't do their job anymore?
Yeah. Now, you know, she's the oldest justice, but not by a lot. So you could ask the same question of Breyer or Kennedy or Scalia. But somehow attention seems to focus on Justice Ginsburg, perhaps because although she's been given a clean bill of health, she's had two battles with cancer.
Well, campaign finance, we mentioned public prayer is an issue that's going before the Supreme Court in this session. What is the case and what's going on?
There's a town in upstate New York called Greece, which opens its town board meetings with a prayer given by a so-called chaplain of the month. That chaplain is almost always Christian, and the prayer is often quite sectarian. And the question is whether that practice violates the First Amendment's ban on the government establishment of religion. And that would seem to be a fairly difficult case were it not for a decision from a few decades ago in which the Supreme Court said that the Nebraska legislature was allowed to hire a minister and put him on the payroll, a Presbyterian minister, and open prayers of legislative open legislative sessions with prayers. And that precedent would seem to suggest that the Supreme Court's going to be okay with this upstate New York practice as well.
And then abortion rights, that's always a hot issue coming to the Supreme Court. What are the particular cases that are headed to the Supreme Court this term?
So there are two abortion-related cases. One of them will definitely be argued and decided this term, and that's about whether Massachusetts was entitled to set up a kind of buffer zone around abortion clinics, depending on your perspective, to limit the free speech rights of people who oppose abortion or to protect the privacy of women in a vulnerable moment in their lives. And there, too, and this is true of a lot of cases this term, there's a precedent that would seem to be very informative. In 2000, the court upheld a similar buffer zone, but the membership of the court has changed some, and I think that 2000 precedent might just be vulnerable. The second abortion case would be a really big deal, but it's not clear it's going to be argued this term. It involves an Oklahoma law that limits the use of drugs that induce abortions. And the U.S. Supreme Court has sent the case back to the Oklahoma Supreme Court for some clarification. But when that case returns to the court, that's going to be a big deal in seeing how what level of abortion restriction the U.S. Supreme Court is prepared to tolerate.
Well, that second one first, is this just part of this ongoing decades-long reexamination of the Roe versus Wade decision?
Yes, and more specifically, in a couple of decades after Roe, the court, with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in the majority, kind of tweaked Roe and said the test now is going to be we're not going to tolerate laws that put an undue burden on women's access to abortion. And the meaning of that term, undue burden, is really in play now that Justice O'Connor has retired from the court, been replaced by the more conservative Justice Samuel Alito, and this case will give us some insight about what counts as an undue burden or not.
And that that change, let's talk about that a little more, Sandra Day O'Connor leaving the court, that had a big impact on a lot of these issues we're talking about, didn't it?
Exactly right. On cases involving affirmative action and other aspects of race, on cases involving campaign finance, religion, abortion, she was at the very center of the court and really moderated and controlled the impulses of both justices on the right and left. When she's replaced by Justice Alito, you immediately see some of her signature work getting dismantled. Citizens United is an example of that, a case on a partial birth abortion law is an example of that, and you see it elsewhere as well.
Now, with that abortion buffer zone rule, as you mentioned, that's a free speech issue in a lot of ways, more than an abortion issue. Can we expect justices to vote the same way they would in an abortion-related issue, or is this a whole different ballgame for them?
Well, the answer is, and you're right to draw that distinction, but I don't think the distinction makes a difference in the voting patterns because there's been a shift in the court, and in many ways, the more pro-First Amendment side tends to be the conservative wing on the court. Those are the reliable votes against restrictions on speech.
On whether we're talking about campaign finance or protests?
Right, or military funerals or laws against violent video games or laws against depictions of animal cruelty. You see the liberals signing on to some of those. But the more conservative justices are fairly consistently quite pro-First Amendment, notably Justices Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts.
One more issue I wanted to get to is, and this is another perennial, it seems like, affirmative action in college admissions. That's coming back again, right?
It is, but it's coming back in an interesting context. The classic question, which the court basically ducked last year, is may a public university take account of race in admissions decisions? And, you know, that question the Supreme Court has grappled with in various ways and never fully answered. The question it's going to decide, and it'll hear argument next Tuesday, is sort of the flip side of it. It's not may universities do it, but can the voters of a state say, we don't want that. We don't want race-conscious admissions. Michigan's voters in 2006 passed a constitutional amendment barring racial preferences. And the question in the new case is, does that state constitutional amendment violate the federal constitution's equal protection clause by putting minorities on a different footing from, say, athletes and college legacy admissions and so on?
And then one more issue. Did I see there's another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, but on contraceptive coverage making its way up to the Supreme Court?
That case has divided the lower courts and is very, very likely to be granted by the Supreme Court and to be heard this term. The question there, and this case has elements of Citizens United, the Affordable Care Act, sex, religion. It's a wonder from a journalist perspective. It's a Christmas present. So the question is, can companies be required to give their employees insurance coverage for contraceptives? And some corporations say that they have a free exercise of religion rights to decline to do so. So it sounds a lot like Citizens United, which found that corporations have free speech rights. Now we'll learn whether corporations have religious free exercise rights.
Interesting. So all these heavily politicized issues this year and in the past couple of terms, it seems, if I take the short view, like the Supreme Court is unusually politicized and a lot of big political items are at stake. Am I just fooling myself and it's always been this way, or is there something different now?
It is a closely divided court, and it's been many decades since you could say this, but every one of the five Republican appointees is more conservative than every one of the four Democratic appointees. So what could be cast as questions of judicial philosophy map on fairly neatly onto the usual ways of thinking about partisan political outcomes. And I don't know that I'd call the court more politicized or even necessarily politicized, but there is a kind of correlation between who appointed these justices and how they vote.
As a Supreme Court correspondent, have you detected a gradual uptick of people really being interested in what's going on there with cases like this coming across the table?
The two sets of cases that ended the last two terms, the Affordable Care Act in 2012 and then same-sex marriage and voting rights this last year, really riveted public attention. I think the cases we've just been talking about are quite important, but I don't think they're going to capture the public imagination quite the same way.
All right. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really fun to be here. Thank you.
That was Adam Liptak. He's the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then the CDC says that a post-antibiotic era may be in our future. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention just released a first-of-its-kind report on the threat of antibiotic-resistant organisms in the United States.
The conclusion, if things don't change, we could soon be in a post-antibiotic era.
That sounds pretty scary, but what does it mean exactly? Bridget Paff is the infection control specialist for Gunderson Health Systems, and she joins us to explain what's going on. Bridget, thanks for being with us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, antibiotic-resistant organisms aren't a new problem. Why is this report raising a few eyebrows?
Well, I think it's raised some eyebrows because it's the first time that we've really shined a spotlight from the CDC to everyone in the community to say, hey, there's 15 organisms in this list that we're very concerned about. I think in the past we've seen some minor outbreaks of community-associated MRSA or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or for common terms to say the superbugs that are out there, whether those outbreaks are in football fields or wrestling locker rooms. It's something that, you know, resistant organisms used to be a thing of, you know, if you look to the nursing homes, and we didn't worry about them, and it's really shining that spotlight on these 15 germs.
Hmm. Well, before we go on to talk about how they've become so resistant, let's talk about how pervasive this issue is. Do you know how many people are affected by antibiotic-resistant organisms these days?
Well, I think each year over 2 million people are infected with a bacteria that has some type of resistance to at least one type of antibiotic. And I think if we look at history, you know, Fleming discovered penicillin way back in 1928. And within, you know, a few years of it being mass produced, there was resistance to penicillin in the community. So it's not, I think antibiotics are one of those few drugs that when overused, it actually decreases their effectiveness versus some most medications. Overuse would lead to other problems.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about that. You mentioned antibiotic use is contributing to this issue. What are some other factors?
Well, they definitely are also utilized as growth promoters in agriculture. A study done right here in Wisconsin back in 2006 was one example that looked at linking infections from the turkey farms to the grocery stores to hospitalized patients. So it is what we're doing in feeding animals in the community as we're raising our food differently than our ancestors did. And again, thinking that pre-antibiotic era and how life was different then and the things that we have done to improve that is in that study, the research showed that there was an association between the human carriage of resistance genes and eating poultry or handling that raw meat.
Well, one thing that I think about, especially when I'm going through the grocery store and looking at all the available cleaning products out there, is I see a lot of antibacterial wipes, antibacterial sprays, and I'm wondering if that is also contributing to the problem, or are we talking about a different class of bacteria altogether when we talk about these resistant strains?
Well, I like to say typically in a lot of the infection control talks we give that mom was right, elbow grease and good old-fashioned vinegar are great house cleaning agents, and making sure that we don't jump onto the hype wagon of saying, well, which chemical should I use? What's going to be the best germ-killing power that these items that I have? Many of those products have an agent called triclosan in them, and there have been some studies that show triclosan in high concentrations can impact and cause the same type of resistance that we look for in these superbugs.
Hmm. So, what are the role of our physicians in this? Can you say that physicians are generally prescribing antibiotics responsibly, or are they being overprescribed in a way?
Well, I think here at Gunderson Health System, we've had an antibiotic stewardship program. This is something that's in place in many hospitals across the state. And it really requires a multidisciplinary approach. The physician, nurse practitioners, especially those nurse practitioners on the front lines, whether they're in small one-room clinics or family medicine doctors in rural clinics, play a huge role. The pharmacist plays a role in those patients who are here in our hospitals. Again, antibiotic resistance isn't a problem as much for my adolescent or my young child in the elementary school as it is for something that we would be concerned about in an intensive care unit patient who has many tubes and drains coming in and out following a horrible surgery, etc. So there's many healthcare workers that play a role in antibiotic resistance and that antibiotic stewardship programs, but the public also plays a role in this, in that not to go for every sniffle and sneeze to seek out your medical provider and ask for that antibiotic. So we've been fortunate here in our community. We've had a collaborative effort among the health systems to really try to have one approach across the community, and I think that's why maybe the state of Wisconsin continues to see a little bit lower numbers than some other states in terms of resistance. But these superbugs are certainly something, as the CDC report alludes to, that there's not a lot of antibiotics in research and development right now. So it's a complex process, and we need to be aware and prepared for those things.
Hmm. So have we gotten too squeamish about bacteria, and as we come into the doctor's clinic and sort of demand antibiotics, what message are the doctors giving, and what education are you putting forth about it?
We definitely have a lot of information readily available in our clinics about how to do symptomatic treatment for those common colds, things that, not every sore throat is a strep throat. So not everything requires antibiotics, and ensuring that patients hear from their providers that they definitely want to help them get better, and sometimes a little chicken soup might be just what the doctor ordered.
Mm-hmm. Did I hear you say that there aren't a lot of new antibiotics in development right now?
Well, getting a new drug to market is a long, complex process. So if I was going to invest my resources investing in something that a patient might get prescribed for high blood pressure for the next 20 years would be a lot better than investing in an antibiotic that might lead to several 5 to 10 day courses of prescriptions being written. Now, does that mean there's no research around antibiotics and new antibiotics? No, definitely not. The NIH and other national organizations are evaluating. And I think a part of what the CDC is asking for in reviewing this report and these highly resistant bacteria is saying we need to pay attention to this as a society, because superbugs are not just a hospital problem anymore. It's a problem facing each and every one of us.
So what action can we individually put forth in order to keep from exacerbating this problem?
Looking at those things where you don't have a high fever, if you've just got the sniffles, considering not overusing those antibiotics for yourself personally. Just as you talked about those antibacterial agents in our home, yes, definitely some of them have a place. But to require that every particular item that you put into your home must be antibacterial, I think we've seen sort of a shift among our marketing out there, as I look at the shelves myself, to more green cleaning products and making sure that we play a role in that so that we're not potentially impacting things. And then looking at resources for hospitals to implement those antibiotic stewardship programs. So I think it's really a joint effort. And I think there's no infection control lesson that's complete without saying, keep your hands clean, either hand sanitizers or wash them with soap and water and rinse away the grime if you've gotten them grossly soiled. Things that in the locker room adolescents can be thinking about, or parents of adolescents should be evaluating what they are sharing in that locker room, not sharing towels or personal hygiene items, making sure that if somebody has an open or draining wound that they're not participating in contact sports and or that that wound is covered.
So in our last minute here, if I do get a superbug, what are my options?
Well, there are some organisms that still have some treatment options. Some of that might include drainage of the lesion or wound. If you do receive an antibiotic for a noted infection, you do want to make sure that you take all of the doses, even if your infection seems to be getting better and you think that you don't need to complete it. So some antibiotics may still be effective. This information, you know, over 2 million resistant organisms in the last year really does indicate that they're resistant to at least one class of antibiotics, not necessarily that they're resistant to everything across the board. And if other people, especially with some of these skin infections that you live with, get the same infection, whether that's painful lesions that oftentimes people think is a spider bite, that they should tell them to go to their regular health care provider to have that evaluated.
Well, Bridget, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you.
That's Bridget Paff. She's the infection control specialist for Gunderson Health System.
Next up, it's the news. Then we'll explore the meanings of courage and fear. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.